I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jake Tapper joins me now. His recent book, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor, has been a bestseller and has gotten great notices. It's a profoundly moving book, sometimes tough to read, but a necessary read. Canadians know full well the sacrifice made in Afghanistan, and this book tells the story of one of America's deadliest battles there. On the 3rd of October 2009, Taliban fighters assault the American combat outpost Keating, in the town of Kamdesh in the Nuristan province of eastern Afghanistan. There were more than 400 Taliban insurgents attacking that remote outpost, and for more than 12 hours, 53 Americans fought back. In the end, 8 soldiers died, 20 were wounded. In the course of this book, you meet these men, those that survived, their families, and the aftermath of this most deadliest of battles. The book sketches out the folly of the placement of this outpost. It was at the bottom of three mountains, which many knew one day would be overrun. As well, we get a sense of the decision-making and debates that went on internally. Focusing on one part of the war, as Mr. Tapper has, one might gain an understanding of the whole Afghanistan conflict, the sacrifice and tragedy, as well as the dignity, bravery, and valor of those abroad and at home who've given so much. We've known Jake Tapper as a television personality, and forget he was a terrific writer at Salon and Talk Magazine. He is a chief Washington correspondent for CNN and soon to be the anchor of a weekday program on the network. He was formerly the senior White House correspondent for ABC News. This book is published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Jake Tapper. Mr. Tapper, good morning.
It's an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. Do you mind if I just ask a couple of questions about CNN before we get into the book?
Of course.
This new show that you have, I guess it'll be weekdays?
Yeah, it'll be Monday through Friday, an hour. It'll probably debut at about, it'll probably debut at 4 o'clock, and then maybe move later in the day once it's up and running. And it will be a broad news show. If you picture, you know, your favorite front page of a newspaper where you pick it up and you see 6 or 7 stories about very different topics ranging from international relations to politics to sports to culture to business, and you want to read every one of them, that's the goal. That's the goal of the show. And we're putting it together right now. I've hired a couple people and still have a few more to hire, and hopefully it will debut in March. That's the goal.
Will you miss covering the White House?
Yeah, I'll miss it. But to be completely honest, you know, that building is very confining. And, you know, I did it for 4 years, and that's a good tour. I felt like I had a good run of it. It's fun to be part of the daily mix, and it's fun to have a job where you can directly ask people in power or their spokespeople the questions that you want to know the answers to. But this will be a new challenge, and hopefully it will be fulfilling as well.
And so, what's the goal that Jeff Zucker has told you he'd like you to do with the show, with the network? I mean, is it to beat Fox, to beat MSNBC, and I guess because CNN's gotten a bad rap in the last few years, is not, you know, being at the top of the ratings, certainly in the United States.
Well, it depends on the day, but yes, yeah. I mean, you know, more people watched CNN's coverage of the inaugural then watched Fox and MS combined. And, you know, when there are big events, whether it's election night or the Democratic convention, more Americans watch CNN than watch anything. But that said, obviously there are ratings challenges. And I think what Jeff Zucker wants to do is to take this great brand of CNN, a network that people want to like and people want to love and people want to be there for them, and live up to those hopes and dreams that not just we who work here have, but also the viewers have. People, there is an interest in having a great cable network that has no partisan agenda. And, you know, I think Jeff's only charge to me is to be great, make it as good as possible, make the show as good as possible, and we, you know, it's funny, we when we met for the first time, we shared some, you know, many of the same views of, you know, what could be a great news program if you had an hour-long, you know, general interest news program. And you know, there are so many stories that don't get covered. And when they do get covered, they don't get covered in as much depth as they could. And so that's the goal, is to just, you know, do that show. There are a lot of great media out there, a lot of great broadcasting broadcast journalism out there. Certainly in Canada, I know there's a lot, and here in the States, there's you know, Marketplace on public radio is great, and National Public Radio does a lot of great stuff, and there are other places. But the idea is just, let's make this great and see what happens.
Now, in the course of writing this book, The Outpost, I mean, you had a full-time job at the White House and working at ABC. When you got to know the people that you talk about in this book, especially those that were killed and those that survived, does it change the sort of reporting that you do, perhaps the questions that you'll ask of the war planners in Washington, say?
Absolutely. It's a great question. Absolutely, it does. Look, my only connection to war, I come from... my family is half Canadian, incidentally.
Oh, really?
I don't think you knew, but
no.
My mom was born in Canada, and my late grandfather served in the Royal Canadian Navy, and he had a brother, Edwin Palmateer, who was with the Royal Canadian Air Force and was a tail gunner and was killed by the Nazis in World War II, or by the Germans at least. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I do not have, or did not have, any real connection to those who serve the U.S. I did not have a connection to people who serve their country. I covered the war, and I covered it from, I covered the war in Iraq. I went to Baghdad for a few weeks and covered it there. And then I covered the war in Afghanistan, mainly from the comfort of the North Lawn of the White House. And looking back on my coverage, now having been through this experience of writing this book about Combat Outpost Keating and getting to know so many of these soldiers, looking back on it, I think my coverage was fairly glib. It was the way wars are often covered from Washington, with fights between this faction and that faction within the White House, with disagreements between the White House and the Pentagon, with debates over surge troop levels, 10,000, 30,000, 40,000. But ultimately, when I look back on it, I think it was rather superficial coverage and not particularly asking the tough questions about what are we doing there, what is it working, will more troops even solve the problem, do the generals know what they're doing, are we waging this war the way it needs to be waged? And I think now, I hope now, and I'm sure I'll fall short of this, but I hope now that my understanding of the true nature of the sacrifices, not just by the soldiers but by their families, will lead me to ask tougher and better questions and to not be as glib as I've been in the past, and that I think too many people in Washington, especially policymakers, are when talking about war, whether it's, you know, going to war in Iraq or Syria or Sudan or Mali, wherever. I mean, I think there is a flippancy about it that that I hope I never engage in again.
And I guess the way that the war has been covered in Afghanistan especially, I mean, it sort of receded from the front page or the top of the newscasts.
Yeah, well, it's America's longest war. It's in its 12th year right now, and, you know, it's a bummer. I mean, it's a downer. It's people don't like bad news.
Now, the story of how you came to write this book, you've told it many times over the last few months now since the book's come out. Your son had just been born.
Jack had just been born. He was born on October 2nd, 2009, and I was in the recovery room with my wife and Jack and our daughter, and I was holding Jack, and I looked up, and on the TV there was this story about this outpost I'd never heard of and a province I'd never heard of. And it was just this unbelievable tale of 53 U.S. troops facing overwhelming Afghan forces, up to 400 Taliban, all of whom had the high ground. It was just a moment that stuck with me. I just wanted to know more about this one outpost. And I can't explain to you why that attack struck me more than, for instance, there had been a different overwhelming attack a year before in this place called Wanat in the same province. It was a brand new camp, not an old one, but that's certainly not the reason why the story of Combat Outpost Keating stuck with me. I think it was just I was holding my son, hearing about eight other sons taken from the world, And I just, it somehow, the poignancy of that moment just stuck with me, and I wanted to know more about Combat Outpost Keating. And you know, this is the same reason why you probably entered journalism, why I entered journalism. I wanted to know more, and I wasn't getting that curiosity satisfied just as a consumer, so I ultimately started calling around.
Are these stories that you'll tell your son one day?
I think so, but he's three, and my daughter's five, and you know, we're still at the age where they are still at the age where we're able to keep sadness out of their lives, and I have not yet told them about slavery or the Holocaust or war. They know about soldiers, but they don't understand what fighting is. When they're old enough, I will tell them about the book, but I don't think I'm going to ask. I don't think they should read it until they're in high school. I was at a book signing north of New York City at Marist College, and there were a couple very precocious seventh grade girls who were at the book reading, and I told their moms to take the books away from them. Just because as a 12-year-old girl or a 13-year-old girl doesn't have to understand about war yet. But at some point it's appropriate. And the truth of the matter is, this book really touched my father. And my father was a big protester of the Vietnam War. And I think by his own admission, he would say that whether or not he was part of it, the American public unfairly blamed troops for the war and did not treat American troops with the respect that they deserved when they came home from that conflict. And I think what this book has done for me and my father both is make us appreciate people from a totally different world than the one we occupy. Like I said, service in the military was not something I was connected to in any way. But now I have a total different appreciation for who these troops are. And even if they entered the service just because they had a drinking problem and they wanted to, you know, get their life in order, or they just had no other options, or whatever the reason, what they end up doing for each other and for, you know, Western society in general is just remarkable. And it's a selflessness that it's difficult to imagine in just ordinary day-to-day life.
So you in the book, we get to meet these eight men that were killed at Outpost Keating. We get a sense of what motivated them, what their lives were like, what they thought of the war. Did you get a sense of, in sort of meeting them as you did in the course of writing this book, that these were guys that you wanted to hang out with, that you wanted to meet, perhaps?
Some of them. I mean, I tried to, not all of them, I tried to present them warts and all. And not just the eight who died in that battle, but as you know, the book tells the story of the creation of the outpost and its existence for a couple years before that attack. And so there are other soldiers whose stories are told. There are a number of soldiers who I would have liked to have known who didn't make it home. Others, you know, probably were more complicated guys or guys that I would not necessarily have gotten along with, but that doesn't make their actions any less valorous. All eight of the men who died that day were killed performing some selfless act, one or another. They, you know, none of them were killed while they were hiding in their barracks. They were all killed returning fire or running out the door with ammunition to deliver to somebody on guard duty, or trying to rescue a friend pinned down in a Humvee. All eight of them were doing something noble, and that's almost the point, is that it doesn't even matter whether I would have liked Kevin Thompson or Vernon Martin or Josh Hart or Josh Kirk or Justin Gallegos or Stephen Mace or, you know, any of the others. They are all different, and they are all unique in their own way, and what's important is that even though they come from all sorts of backgrounds, there was within them this ability to do that which so many of us would not do, which is risk our lives to save a fellow soldier.
And the experience of getting to know their families, I mean, that must be extraordinary.
It's moving. It's you know, these are people who, for whom the war will never be over, and, you know, different widows and different moms of these fallen troops deal with it in their own way and on their own recovery scale. Some of them are trapped in the day where they found out their son was killed or their husband was killed. Others have proved to the, you know, to have a greater ability to move on. But knowing them is an honor, and you know, I'm friends with a lot of these people now and stay in touch with them. One of the guys in the book who made it, Staff Sergeant Clint Romichet, who's kind of a tough character in the book, a heroic character in the book, he'll actually be coming to Washington, D.C. in a couple weeks. He's the President Obama is going to give him the Medal of Honor, which in this country is a very rare award given, I guess, of in the wars of in Afghanistan and Iraq. Only there are only four living Medal of Honor recipients. Clint will be the fifth, and he's coming. And you know, I'm throwing a reunion party for a bunch of the guys and their families, and that will be nice on just on a personal level.
Yeah. Now, is what happened at Combat Outpost Keating that day in that October day in 2009, is that indicative of, say, the entire Afghanistan experience? I mean, when we think of what went wrong in Afghanistan, is this something that's representative of that?
It is. You know, I don't know the war. The end of this war has not happened yet, so I can't tell you whether it's going to have an ending in which we can say that it was worth it to a degree. That you know, the Afghan people now have a government that thrives, and there will no longer be a safe haven for terrorists in Afghanistan, which is, I suppose, is the point. So it's tough to say. I will say that the book serves as a microcosm of the war in Afghanistan in two ways. One is it really describes how difficult the work is. And at this stage in the war, 2006 to 2009, the Americans and the international forces, so not just Americans, I should say, Canadians and others, French, Belgians, Poles, Latvians, were trying to do what is called counterinsurgency, which is connecting the people of Afghan to their government, trying to develop the country economically. And it really describes how just tough that work is to win over people who do not want you there. And, you know, generations of Afghans before have kicked out other empires. And so that's one way it's a microcosm. And two, I think it's a microcosm in terms of who we have serving for us in this country and in Canada as well, I suppose, and what they're willing to do for us. But in terms of a larger message of, you know, Afghanistan, you know, Afghanistan is a tragedy the way that Combat Outpost Keating was a tragedy, I'm not prepared to say that just because I don't know how that book ends.
And when you think about it, I mean, there were 53 soldiers at the outpost, 400 Taliban, thereabouts, 8 killed, 20 wounded. I mean, a lot more survived than were killed, right?
That's true. Yes, and the U.S. can say, you know, we won that battle. I mean, it was tragic, and 8 men were killed, 8 Americans were killed, and that was the deadliest day for the U.S. that year in Afghanistan. But we did push back the Afghan attack, and they did not take over the camp, and they only killed 8 out of 53. That is true. 8 out of 53 is a very high percentage of Americans who were there. It's not the same kind of body count that you got in Vietnam or World War II or World War I or Korea, so in that way it's different. But it's still a lot of people to have been killed for an outpost that at that point in the outpost's existence wasn't really achieving anything other than its own defense. And a U.S. Army investigation after the battle concluded that the camp had no strategic or tactical value at all at that point.
So is what we're supposed to take from this that had there been, say, roads, the infrastructure, had there been helicopters in Afghanistan rather than, say, in Iraq, this wouldn't have happened?
I can't say it wouldn't have happened, but certainly if the U.S. troops in Afghanistan had as much in terms of assets and manpower as their fellow soldiers in Iraq had, you know, things would have been different. That's for sure. As you know from reading the book, one of the reasons the outpost was put at the bottom of Three Steep Mountains is because they needed to be near the road for resupply because there were so few helicopters in Afghanistan in 2006. So in this mountainous part of Afghanistan at the base of the Hindu Kush mountain range, you're either going to be on a mountain or at the bottom of it. And so they had to be at the bottom of it because that's where the road was, and they needed to be near the road so that they could get food and ammunition and supplies. It's really just that simple. I think that, you know, it's unquestioning, unquestionably, that if you're going to send U.S. troops to battle or Canadian troops to battle, you should make sure they have everything they need to achieve their objective, whether it's helicopters or manpower or HESCO barriers or ammunition. And if you're not prepared to do that, then you shouldn't send them to battle, because otherwise you have a bunch of U.S. troops, a bunch of brave people who are willing to do anything for their country, who are just sitting ducks.
Well, what happens now after 2014? I mean, is the Afghan army ready?
In my last trip to Afghanistan, which was 2011, I was embedded at Forward Operating Base Bostik, which is close to where Keating was. And the major who commanded the 227 Wolfhounds, the infantry unit that I was with, he told me that he thought that they would be ready, but he was concerned about the logistical effort, meaning the Afghans will be there, the National Army, the Afghan security forces, the Afghan border patrol, the Afghan police will be there, and they'll be ready to do what they need to do. But was the infrastructure there to supply these individuals with ammunition, with medevac helicopters, with the ability to exist? This isn't the brave and heroic part of war when we think about war, but it's the necessary part. You need to, it's very difficult. This is, you know, one of the things illustrated in the book is how important the logistical support is and how difficult a part of war planning it is. So that's a real concern. And when I was embedded with a medevac unit on that same trip, I was embedded with the All-American Dust-Off medevac unit at Bagram Air Base, I was embedded with them, and the medevac picked up a wounded Afghan border patrolman and took him to an Afghan base. And we sat on the tarmac for half an hour waiting for the Afghans to get their act together and bring their ambulance out to the helicopter and pick up their own wounded soldier, and it was maddening. And the medevac crew said that it was par for the course, that the Afghans just they're not there yet. Now, that was a year and a half ago, and hopefully they've made advances since then. But you know, it's you can't turn a country that is you can't. Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's just put it that way. I don't want to offend anybody ethnographically.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is such an extraordinary book and a life-changing one for you and your family. Will you write another book soon?
I don't know. I don't know is the short answer. I really don't know. It would be great to do another one, but I don't know what it would be about, and I don't know... I had such passion for this one, and I was just so driven to write it, and all these troops became like invested in my telling their stories and the story of their brothers and the families that got invested too, and it became something that I had to do, and that enabled me to write it on weekends and at night. And I have a difficult time at this point imagining being so inspired again. But certainly it was a very rewarding experience professionally and emotionally also.
You've done a remarkable service with this book. It's been a pleasure having you on today to talk about this, Jake, and we'll watch for you on CNN.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the conversation.
The book is called The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. It's published by Little Brown. Its author, Jake Tapper, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.